Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you. Hosted by your local Labor MPs.
And good morning, it's Phil Goff here, MP for Mount Roskill, representing the Labor Party, welcoming you to Red Alert Radio on Planet FM 104.6. Well, the issues I want to talk about today are the issues that really dominated last week. I've got to say that the term roast busters is something that I wish I'd never heard of. What this term applied to was a group of young men on Facebook describing themselves on this way, a takeoff on Ghostbusters. And these particular young men were boasting on Facebook about how they'd get girls intoxicated, some of them as young as 13, and then have group sex with them. Frankly, along with everybody else in New Zealand, I was appalled and disgusted at what these young men were doing. Not only appalled because of the lack of ethics, the lack of treatment of fellow human beings as human, but because what they were actually doing was totally illegal, and yet nothing seems to have been done to bring their activities to a halt. For a start, we do have an age of consent in New Zealand. It's 16, and I believe that's where basically it ought to be. I believe that under the age of 16, a boy or a girl is not in the best position in terms of maturity to make a decision about sex. Secondly, when a person is intoxicated, they're incapable of giving consent. Sex without consent is sexual violation. That is a serious criminal matter. And thirdly, and I think probably the thing that sickens me as much as anything about this, for these guys to seek to humiliate the victims of their offending by naming them on Facebook says something that our society, our culture, has some serious problems about it. I don't think the police force, to be frank, as well as trying to be fair, have covered themselves in glory over this. They first of all said there were no complaints when there were four complaints. I didn't get the sense that they followed this up seriously, and some of the questions they were asking the young complainant were questions that implied that maybe she was responsible for her own dilemma. And then we had the radio shows, Radio Live, I'll name them, where the hosts, JT and Willie, did exactly the same thing. You know, why were you girls intoxicated? Weren't you responsible for this? Why did you associate with these guys? They were to blame, not the guys whose behaviour was quite predatory. And I was, frankly, quite pleased to see some of the advertisers withdrawing their advertising as a protest to that sort of attitude. We've got to raise the question, I guess, of the court process. Is our court process the best process we can have to deal with matters of sexual abuse and sexual violation? New Zealand, across the board in our justice system, runs a system which is adversarial. We have the prosecution and we have the defence lawyer, and it's a contest, a little bit like in Parliament, actually. In a lot of the European jurisdictions, they have what's called the inquisitorial process, where you have a panel of judges who actually try to find the truth of the matter. And maybe, in regard to sexual abuse and violation cases, the inquisitorial system would serve both the interests of the victims and the interests of justice much better. And then we've got the question of Facebook and what can be done today to spread material instantaneously, rapidly and anonymously that can be incredibly damaging and hurtful to people. And when it's put up there and downloaded, it can be around forever. So a lot of issues arising out of the so-called roast busters controversy of last week. Well, today my guest on this topic is Dr. Kim McGregor. Kim is the Executive Director of Rape Prevention Education. She's contributed to a number of sexual violation prevention programs. She's worked in schools for schools-based programs. and she's worked to raise awareness about sexual violence, including working with sexual survivor advocate Louise Nicholas. She has been a therapist with survivors of sexual abuse for more than 25 years. Kim, whom I've known for a lot of that time, is a really competent and committed professional and a very good person to boot. So, Kim, welcome to the program today, and thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, kia ora, Phil. Thank you so much.
Can we begin by getting you to tell us a little bit about what you do with the Rape Prevention Education program that you're executive director of?
Sure, thank you for that. Rape Prevention Education was Rape Crisis Auckland Incorporated for almost 30 years. We changed the name in 2006 because about 10 years prior, the organisation had decided that there were enough other sister organisations in Auckland that was doing frontline work, the traditional sort of rape crisis work, which was attending to police statements, call-outs, medical forensic examination support for survivors of sexual violence. And Rape Crisis Auckland decided that it would focus on sexual violence prevention. And so it took the school program and called it Body Safe, and we're that's our largest school-based program probably in the whole country. We've got a team of about 10 very enthusiastic educators, male and female, from a range of ethnicities that go into, depending on our funding, anywhere between 20 and 40 high schools in the Greater Auckland area. We know that there are over 100 high schools, so we've got to find out ways that we can extend our reach to get to every high school in the country. The program particularly focuses on respectful sexual relating, because we know that that's not taught in high schools. Their family planning go in, and often it's great if they go in before us so that they're talking about sex, from a physiological point of view, mm-hmm. whereas we go in afterwards and we talk about sex is not about body parts, it's not just about STIs, it's about relating with another human being or more than one, and respecting that person's wishes. So we also teach about consent law, and that we have on our sex and respect website for young people, we've got 4 steps to consent. Then we've also got another program that we take also into high schools called Sex and Respect Parties, and that's for the older age group, to help them navigate the areas around partying and alcohol. And then we have another program that would go into the alternative education schools. We've run out of funding for that, so we can't run that one anymore. But when we were going into alternative education groups, we found that there were almost 100% disclosures of sexual violence from those groups, and including some, you know, teen mums, and we've been working with teen dads. And then we have an advocacy arm. So I met Louise Nicholas in 2006, and I got her basically a job to work with us to raise awareness of sexual violence. And then we have another arm, which is working with Māori, and we have Korowai Tūmanako that works with us to work on sexual violence prevention with clinical Māori specialists developing and delivering those programs. And we also have another arm, which is teaching healthcare professionals and community workers how to deal with disclosures of sexual violence, because most tertiary qualifications, and this includes doctors, nurses, psychiatrists, psychologists, healthcare professionals, there's no training in how to deal with sexual violence. So we're trying to plug that gap, but we've got no funding for that either. So most of those programs have ceased. So we're really, the only program we're running is, Body Safe, and we've got a contract for Louise Nicholas through the Ministry of Justice, and we have the Rangatahi program. But we've shrunk a little bit over the last year because we're running out of funding.
Well, I'll pick up that point first because it to me it just seems crazy. We have a very legalistic approach to matters of sexual violation and sexual abuse. And, of course, if we are able to get a conviction against a person, that person may do, anything from 4 to 8 or 9 years in prison. And that's $100,000 a year.
Absolutely,
to keep that person in prison.
Yep.
And having that person in prison doesn't undo the damage that they have done through their actions.
Yep.
And I'm just listening to what you're saying now, as a member of parliament, as a legislator, saying how bloody crazy that we put all of the money into the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff.
Mm.
We'll get our vengeance on the person that's committed these wrong acts, but we're not prepared to put the fence at the top of the cliff, both to protect the victim, and the victim is often but not exclusively female, but also to try to teach young men who are discovering their sexuality at a point where they don't have maturity or experience or anything else, to tell them that a relationship is about respecting the other person and not simply the physical side of that relationship. Wow, we need to look again at this area. So
absolutely.
I think maybe you and I could have a chat about
that. Would be great.
Yeah. Let me come. You mentioned Louise Nicholas, and Louise is a person that I have just enormous respect for because of the absolute courage that she had in going public and having her name in the public arena about the absolutely appalling behaviour of New Zealand police. I think it's going back, is it 10 years now? Or is it a bit longer? Men who were police officers, mature men, who were behaving in the way that this group of people, the Roastbusters, were behaving. And that led to, of course, a big inquiry, and we had a long, hard look at police culture, and Dame Margaret Baisley, who is well respected, did the report on that and said these things are wrong about the culture, they have to change. We had a review of that before our select committee and said, yeah, made some progress, but hey, still a long way to go. Let's start by looking at the police response to this stuff up on Facebook. It wasn't really very adequate from what I can tell, and I'm not prejudging it. We'll go to the Independent Police Complaints Authority, but it does look like that some of the attitudes haven't changed, doesn't it? I mean, asking the girl about how she was dressed and why she was associating with the men, that puts the responsibility on her as the victim rather than the responsibility on the perpetrator of the alleged offences.
And I think you alluded to the police need, when they say they need enough evidence, and then we ask ourselves what is the level of evidence that they need, and they need enough evidence to get it across the very high bar that is beyond reasonable doubt. Your comments about inquisitorial processes, we absolutely support. And I think the police, when they're asking questions about clothing, I'm wondering whether they are thinking ahead to a jury situation and thinking that juries have a lot of rape myths that they hold, just like the general public usually. So we know from Amnesty International studies in the general public that the general public will blame a woman for being partially or totally responsible for being raped if she was drinking, if she wore revealing clothing, if she flirted. The research from Amnesty International shows that is a third or a half of the general public's attitudes. And we know that the police are drawn from the general public. We know that the jury is drawn from the general public. And that's why when the Law Commission started looking at pre-trial and trial processes, they were looking at inquisitorial processes in other jurisdictions and looking at that as a fairer process for a rape complainant to be able to step into a court of law. Because at the moment, as you and I know, the defence lawyers run the courts. The judge is not in charge of the court. And when the adversarial process is at its worst, when the defence lawyers are calling rape survivors sluts and liars, trying to destroy their credibility to get their client a not guilty verdict, then it's not a fair process, because the defendant can sit there in silence and have his or her a defence lawyer do this very brutal, hostile sort of adversarial approach. And we've got rape survivors saying that they felt almost re-raped through that whole situation, where they're in the court of law, they're talking about the humiliating, degrading and traumatic experiences of what that is sexual violence, and in public to a whole group of strangers, and then they're being accused of flirting, or they asked for it, or they consented, and so when the Law Commission looked at the inquisitorial processes, so there's a report sitting there in the Law Commission's office that hasn't come to the light of day. And I think that, as I say, when I go back to the police, what they're looking for in terms of the level of evidence, is that what they're looking for? And are they assessing each case and thinking, oh, well, the jury will just dismiss this because the young girl sent a text or something to say that she was keen on this guy, and then it's as though that's tantamount to consent. We know it's not, but I think that's the issue.
I think that's absolutely the case, and the police know that if they take the case to court, they do have to, as you say, prove it on that very high standard of beyond reasonable doubt. And they don't want to take cases only to find that they lose the case in court. They've put hours and hours and hours of work in it. The woman who was the victim has to go through that, and then at the end of it feels like she's the one that's been found guilty because the alleged offender has been found, quote-unquote, innocent. So I guess that is a good point. And I'll come to that Law Commission report, because the Law Commission basically was proposing things that I was getting to at the end of my time as Minister of Justice, where I looked at the statistics, and maybe I'll just go over the statistics for our listeners, that of the people who suffer from sexual violation or attack, 10 out of 100, I think it is that go to report it to the police.
Yep.
Of those, 3 of the 10, that's 3 out of 100, will actually get to court. And of those, slightly more than 1 out of the 3 will secure a conviction. So you've got to say, how good is our justice system at protecting people who are the victims of sexual violation if 1% of those succeed in getting justice? You could almost say that the woman that says, I'm not going to get justice from the system and therefore I won't lodge a complaint, is taking a very rational stance, because our system isn't designed to see justice done and to restore the position of the victim. And I just think what you've said about defence lawyers is absolutely right. Okay, they would say in their own defence, we've got to go out and we've got to put the best case we can for the defendant. But in doing so, they actually make the victim the person that's on trial. It's all about the victim. Did you lead this guy on? Were you responsible for what he did to you? Well, you know, where is the responsibility of the person who is the offender? And that seems to be lost. So maybe we've got to change our justice system, and the system where you have an adversarial system does not produce justice, particularly in this area. And maybe we have to get our head around the fact that even though we've run the English system for the whole of our existence, maybe it's not the best system. And I regret the fact that the Minister of Justice has just left the Law Commission report to gather dust, and basically in the House last week said, no, we're not about to change all of this. I think maybe we've got to think about changing all of this because the status quo doesn't work.
Yep, and we put in 500 submissions requesting that the Law Commission research was written into a report and put into the general public's arena so that the general public could have a look at it. Some of the changes that the Law Commission were suggesting are already in our system. It's just, and it's not as though moving to some of the inquisitorial processes, the evidence will still be tested, but it will just be tested in a fairer, more dignified way for both parties. And one of the suggestions was basically to do away with juries, but to have a smaller jury, to have specialist jurors. One or two, the judge would be in charge of the case. The judge would be asking of both parties. Now, the defendant has got the right to silence, doesn't have to answer, but the judge will ask both parties what happened in a much fairer way, and they still want to test the evidence, but it will just be more humane.
I remember very clearly, and it was quite a long time ago. It was in my last year as Minister of Justice, but I met a group of rape survivors, and what I anticipated was actually absolutely wrong about them. I anticipated there'd be a group of very angry and bitter people that felt that they had suffered this degradation and they'd never seen justice, and they would have a punitive attitude towards those who had committed these offences against them. I actually couldn't have been more wrong. What they said to me was they weren't after, you know, the defendant having 12 years in prison or even a fraction of that time. What they were really after was an acknowledgement on the part of the offender that they had committed a wrong and an acknowledgement of remorse at what they'd done. And I was just swept away by that. And, you know, maybe we would get a lot more justice for a lot more people if we did have an alternative system that people, that the victim could choose to go down, that she didn't want the offender in a court and tried and locked up, but she wanted acknowledgement and she wanted remorse and maybe some form of recompense. And, you know, maybe that's another area that we have to examine as well. What do you think?
Absolutely. So we can improve the current adversarial process, and we can also increase maybe the 20% that might go through a restorative justice process. You're quite right about rape survivors, and we can't talk, you know, blanket for everyone. Some rape survivors absolutely want justice, and they want, you know, the person locked up. But many, because most offenders are known, like 90% of the time they'll be known to the rape survivor. Very rarely it's 10 to 15% of the time it's a stranger, and often they care about that person, and it might be their father or, you know, somebody within their family. And even with these guys, you know, called roastbusters, some of the girls may like some of the guys. They may not want them to, you know, go to jail for a long period of time, but what they may want, and I don't want to talk about this case in particular, but they may want is that, just as you've said, they want them to stop the behaviour so that nobody else is harmed. They want them to acknowledge that they have caused harm and make sure that they don't do it again. So quite often rape survivors will want the person, the offender or alleged offender, to have treatment. And that's what we want as a society, to have a safe society, is if we've only got at the moment one out of 100 offenders that have some kind of sanction against them, then we're not creating a safe society. Mm-hmm. So what about the other 99? We want them, if nothing else, we want them to have treatment so that they stop their behaviour.
Yeah. No, look, I'm absolutely convinced that that's the way in which we need to go. And I suppose out of, you know, the events of last week and the controversy around it, we might see some positives come out, that people might start to look at what we need to do to make a real difference. For the first time, probably people are hearing that there was a Law Commission report that said that we needed to do it in a different way. And Andrew Little, Labor's justice spokesperson, has been very strong on that, and I think that he has an absolute commitment. So we may see a future Minister of Justice that is prepared to act in that way. Do you have any other, I mean, what other responses do you have out of the controversy around this particular group of young men? I know we don't want to in any way jeopardise a fair process of justice for them. But
I've been heartened by the public response to this case. People have been absolutely outraged. And I think it was the bravado, the boasting, the arrogance, the misogyny of these young men that came across to the public. Now, mostly it's only rape survivors that would ever see that. Mm. This was very much public. And so it was really heartening that the public are on the side of the victim survivors at the moment, which is fantastic, because, you know, in other times when people hear of drunk young women, there's often blame associated with them. So this time was different, and that's really great. And I think we need to build on that and help the public understand that rape survivors need support, because quite often the reason they don't report is because they blame themselves, and they know that the public usually would blame them if they've been drinking or if they've been doing something that's disapproved of. So we've got to remember that there are 1 out of 3 to 5 girls who experience sexual violence in this country, and somewhere between 1 in 6 to 10 boys. A huge percentage of the population experience sexual violence. And so we've got to start talking about this at every stage in a person's life. My hope is that we would get a strategy together, a prevention strategy, where we would have, we've got preschool programs, I've got puppet programs to teach people about, you know, good and bad touching. That's got to be built upon at age-related appropriate language and reinforcing messages in a step-by-step situation, so that it becomes the norm. And and we teach bystander intervention so that, you know, people will say this is not okay behaviour and, you know, not support it. There's lots that we can do, but we are up against a multi-billion dollar pornography industry and music video industry, and we've got very little resources to combat that. So if government and our specialist sexual violence intervention and prevention sector can get together and develop a strategy, and we did have a strategy developed through the Task Force for Action on Sexual Violence in 2009, but that National Sexual Violence Prevention Plan was never released. It's somewhere in government. I don't know where it is. I worked on that for a year with others. But we need a national plan with community and government working together.
Yeah, look, I think all of those points are very good, and perhaps the positive out of this is that we will now see a greater focus on things that can make a real difference, make a difference in changing our culture, make a difference in government putting resources into the area of prevention, find a more effective way of people being able to see justice done. Then maybe all of the appalling actions, alleged actions, I suppose I should say, of this group of young men might produce something better for all of us. Kim, look, thank you very much both for being on the program today, but thank you very much for all of the incredibly good work that you've done over a long period of time. It must be incredibly frustrating for you to wait so long to see a proper response from the system, but keep up the good work, and I hope that our discussion today has informed our listeners in a way that will help change public opinion as well. This is Phil Goff, Member of Parliament for Mount Roskill, thanking our listeners on Red Alert Radio today. Look forward to catching up with you next week, next Thursday at 9:05.
Get together with your local MP next week at 9:05 a.m. Or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalertradio.